I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome to Radio Times. There's a primary election in Pennsylvania next Tuesday in the race between incumbent Philadelphia District Attorney Larry Krasner and his Democratic challenger, Carlos Vega, has been heating up. 4 years ago, Krasner, a longtime civil rights and defense attorney, ran on a progressive platform of reforming the criminal justice system, ending cash bail, reducing the penalties for petty crime, reducing the jail population, and holding the police department accountable for misconduct. The Fraternal Order of Police has unleashed a campaign of billboards and ads against Krasner, blaming him for the huge spike in gun violence in the city and for the treatment of crime victims. 2020 was one of the worst years for homicides in many years, and 2021 is on track to repeat or even exceed those numbers. This race is about many things, including whether criminal justice reform can survive the increase in violent crime. Larry Krasner joins us on Radio Times to talk about what he plans to do if he is elected. He joins us by Skype. And Larry Krasner, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Always great to be here, Marty, except I want a mug. How am I going to get a mug this time?
I think I gave you a mug. You have a Radio Times mug. I have that documented.
Well, we'll discuss it later.
Fair enough. Let me just make sure our listeners can join us. Larry Krasner will be with us for the next 40 minutes, and you can join us as well. Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. Such an important race, and we want to hear your questions and your comments. Larry Krasner, let me begin with the fact that in 2020, 499 people were murdered in Philadelphia. Looking at a police report from last night, as of last night at midnight in 2021, 190 victims of homicide compared to 2020, 137. So clearly 2021 is worse than 2020. People in Philadelphia, in any city, look to the police department, but also look to the district attorney's office to keep them safe. What hasn't your office been able to do to keep this crime rate down?
So, you know, obviously it's a heartbreaking situation, not just for the victims, not just for the survivors, but it's a heartbreaking situation for police, for EMT personnel, for people who live in those neighborhoods, for people who knew the ones who were shot. I mean, it's heartbreaking for me when I go to the crime scenes and when I am sometimes at the bedside in these hospitals. It's a very, very painful thing for all of us. It's nothing that we want to see. But if we are going to address the issue, we have to be honest about the issue, and we have to look at what's actually going on. Our conviction rate in the DA's office, as of the period right before the courts effectively shut down because of the pandemic, was nearly 85% for fatal and non-fatal shootings. That is an extremely high rate of conviction. It is a rate of conviction that was among the very highest in Philly over the last 5 years, and compares very favorably to other cities. Simply put, we do the work, and we do it well in terms of prosecuting these cases. We have a bigger issue in Philadelphia, which is that historically the solve rate has been quite low. The right. Solve rate for non-fatal shootings has been about 20%, and due to the challenges that the police department, like all of us, have faced during the pandemic, so, you know, that is a small part of the problem. But if we are honest about this, then we will look at the fact that the 50 major cities in the United States had an increase last year that was on average 42%. The increase in Philadelphia was almost that. It was 40%. Anybody who tries to tell you that what's happening in Philadelphia is unique is just telling you something that is untrue. What is happening in Philadelphia is very much in line with these other cities. Sure. And when we look more carefully to see, is it Democratic cities? Is it Republican cities? Is it cities with traditional prosecutors or cities with progressive prosecutors or progressive chiefs of police? When we look to see that, there is no pattern there. This has been studied by criminologists. You just can't point and blame to a particular philosophy or administration. But what we do see is that the common thread here is a whole layer of really essential protection and prevention involving young people has been stripped away. We have no organized sports in or out of school now. And I'm 60. I've never seen anything like that. It's been a year. We have closed high school classrooms. We have closed houses of worship with their programming effectively closed. We have summer camps shut down, rec centers shut down, swimming pools shut down. You know, this is an unprecedented situation. Even normal places where young people like to go, like movie theaters, shut down. Employment in a low dollar economy, like I had when I was a teenager. I used to work for, you know, a contractor who did kitchen remodeling, shut down. So what we are seeing is that as you strip away every aspect of this normal layer of prevention, something that's happening all over the country, we have this surge in gun violence all over the country. And it's not even just in the big cities. It's a national rate that increases at 18%.
I mean, I hear you, and it is true. It is happening across the country. Nonetheless, the district attorney, and in your case, your office, has a unique responsibility. And yes, the pandemic has made life difficult for so many people, and obviously is one of the reasons for the increase in gun violence. But nonetheless, what could your office do? And as we look into the future, you want to get reelected. What can you do in the future to address this problem?
Well, let me tell you what we have done, because I think it shows you what we are going to continue to do into the future. So one of the first things we did, and this is 2 years ago, this is before the pandemic, is we said it's taking too long for shooting cases to go from initiation to completion. It was about 305 days. We worked with the courts in order to expedite that. Before the pandemic hit, we had reduced the amount of time from beginning of a shooting case to the end to close to 180 days. We almost cut it in half. And that is good for victims. It is good for witnesses. But it's also good for people who are locked up on a case and who may contend that they are innocent. So that was one thing we did. Another thing we did is we spoke to Kim Fox in Chicago, another progressive DA, who had some success in putting prosecutors out at police districts where there was a high level of shootings so that those prosecutors could work directly with police. We did that, you know, and we did it with the agreement of our current police commissioner. We appreciate that. And we did it on a bigger scale than they did in Chicago. We have two prosecutors assigned to each of the six detective divisions around the city. We were invited to try to assist them with investigating shootings as best we can, and we've done that. So that was the second thing we did. A third thing we did that I think is extremely important is we united our prosecutors who do shooting cases into the same unit with those who do homicide cases so we could have the best and highest level of mentoring of talented, hardworking young attorneys so they could be better at what they do. And when we saw that, we saw a very impressive increase in conviction rates as a result of many of these factors. The last two things we did more recently is we have a weekly review with the police department where their senior people and our senior people look at every gun violence case, new gun violence case from that week in certain categories, and we look for gaps. We look for flaws in the case itself that we try to fix. We look for flaws in training on either side or in performance on either side that can be remedied in various different ways. And that has been so successful. I can give you some examples, but can't go on forever. But
no,
that's been
can't.
So successful. That's been so successful that now we actually have been offered a seat inside the police intelligence unit where 24/7 we can work with them on brand new cases instead of looking backward at cases from that week.
But are you saying looking ahead that all these actions that have been put into place will actually reduce the gun violence in Philadelphia?
I'm saying that will certainly improve the performance of our office in terms of prosecuting them. That will have some effect on gun violence. But the truth is that the big effect that we need here is going to come from prevention. And it's not just restoring all the programs I mentioned that were shut down. It's not just from refunding them and opening swimming pools and rec centers. It is from realizing how important they were and being willing to reinvest more heavily. So, for example, you know, we really don't have school nurses like we used to in Philadelphia. We need that. We don't have school counselors like we used to. We need that. We need to reduce our class size from sometimes 35 down to something much more reasonable, you know, 22 or 17. These things are going to become possible with significant taxation coming off of recreational day use marijuana. We need to take that seriously because we see now how incredibly important that is.
You mentioned crime victims, and a number of crime victim family have been critical of you. There was and I'm quoting here from the Philadelphia Inquirer, Asian American store owners outraged by a plea deal for a man who shot a West Philadelphia deli owner daylight with an AK-47. And the victim said, Krasner and his associates never contacted me. This was a plea deal that your office put into place. The Philadelphia Inquirer that did endorse you also said that you should devote more attention and more staff towards working with families of crime victims. You agree?
I agree that we should always do more and we should always do better. I agree that there have been mistakes in the past in our administration and in prior administrations. We've taken them seriously. And that's part of the reason, for example, that we started a first ever program called the CARES program, where we provide 45 days of intensive services to the families of homicide victims. This is a grant-funded program, now funded for another period in a few million dollars. That's been very, very successful and helpful both to victims and also to police department. Never existed before. We also were concerned that both in this and prior administrations, there was imperfect communication with victims. And that is always a difficult thing because cell phone numbers change, addresses change, victims often are broke like defendants in criminal court. So, you know, we talked to statewide victim advocates. They advised on some additional databases we could use to search for people. We bought those, we bought licenses to those databases, and we have made our own staff much more accountable for writing down every single effort to contact victims and survivors to make sure they're informed as they have to be. You know, the law says it's got to be reasonable. We want to do more than reasonable, and we will continue to push those efforts.
Here's an email from Ed asking, does Krasner take ownership for his liberal policies towards the uptick in violence? You can't cut back on police, and it is foolish to think more recreation centers will turn things around.
What do you say? I must respectfully disagree. During this administration, meaning this mayoral administration, there has been an increase of at least $120 million in the police budget. Our police budget now approaches $800 million. And there is no indication, either in Chicago or in Philadelphia, two chronically violent cities, that having outsized police departments in Philly, we have the sixth largest city and the fourth largest police department, similar situation in Chicago. There's no evidence that more and more boots on the ground is addressing this problem at all. We have to look at the reality here, which is that the administrations of Lynn Abraham and many other DAs that mostly talked tough but didn't do a very good job at actually reining in violence failed. And we have to be real that there are more guns on the street for less money now than there were 35 years ago. It is time to move towards what works, what has worked in Los Angeles, what has worked during certain periods in Chicago when it was heavily funded, is serious investment in community-based organizations to the tunes of tens of millions of dollars over many years. It causes long-term reductions in gun violence and also reductions in jail. Let me just say, the other day, my office committed to putting $1 million in forfeiture money, basically money coming from drug dealers during criminal investigations, into community-based organizations. We distributed five $25,000 grants, and we have called on the city, we have called on our academic institutions and private industry to find the rest of the money. We got $1 million, we're looking for another 99. And that is a request coming from the black clergy, coming from community groups, and coming increasingly from members of our city council and other elected officials. I respect the question and how it has been phrased, as sure. I respect questions from anyone. But that's not the way to go. The way to go, without question, is towards prevention, because it has shown that it actually works.
And that is Larry Krasner. He is Philadelphia District Attorney running for re-election. You can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with District Attorney Larry Krasner. He is the incumbent here in Philadelphia. He is making his case for re-election. I should say his Democratic challenger, Carlos Vega, will be our guest tomorrow, Thursday, on Radio Times. Larry Krasner, in preparation for today's show, I did my homework, and one of the things that I came across, even from supporters, people that supported you 4 years ago and support your reelection, have described you as arrogant and abrasive and combative, don't have the kind of retail politics skills. Even in the documentary about you, Philly DA, your wife, who's a judge here in Philadelphia, tells you, Larry, be nice. Is that hard for you?
Is it hard for me to be nice? I guess it depends what we're talking about. First of all, I accept all of that criticism. You know, I think that there is something in anyone who's willing to run for elected office that is a little arrogant and that is a little willing to push back when people push. So I think that's part of it. Maybe viewing this movement and viewing myself as having been for outsiders, for people who are marginalized, mm-hmm. maybe that puts even a little bit more of a chip on your shoulder. So I accept that that may be some of how I am perceived. Maybe that's something that I give off at times. But I can also say that I think if you look at the heart of what we're trying to do here, to end mass incarceration, to end mass supervision, to bring about justice for poor people and black and brown people, you know, I think that ultimately we have good intentions. And if I misstep at times, you know, I'm willing to take the blame for that.
And I do want to get back to some of the issues, but it is interesting, and this is a political observation. You are not endorsed by the mayor of Philadelphia or the attorney general of Pennsylvania or the Democratic Party in the city. Ed Rendell, who was a mayor, who was a district attorney and was governor here in Pennsylvania, has endorsed your opponent. Does that say something about the Democratic Party, something about you? Is there a rift here?
So everything you've just described is exactly what happened last time I ran. We did not have the endorsement of any of these, you know, more institutional elected officials or more institutional members of the party. And let us understand that we won with more votes than any DA campaign in at least the last 20 years, maybe longer than that. I just say 20 because that's how long the electronic records went back. The people vote and the people make these decisions. And when the people are ready for a change that institutions are not ready to embrace, then you're going to see this kind of a difference. You know, the fact is there are about 66 wards in Philadelphia. We won 51 of them last time, based upon what I see from individual ward leaders, because all the ward leaders obviously can pick whichever candidate they prefer. I doubt we're going to lose even one. I think we're probably going to take about 51 wards again. And more to the point, I think that we are going to have a decisive victory like we did last time that is going to send a message to institutions that are not quite ready for change, that the people are ready for change. And that's why they've picked this movement. They haven't necessarily picked me. I'm not the point. But they have picked a movement. And that movement is not just being picked in Philly. 10% of the United States, 10% of the United States has now elected and in many cases reelected a progressive prosecutor, because that is exactly what the people want, and the institutions are trying to catch up.
I saw a tweet today from Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis from Georgia. She says that she will seek the death penalty for the Atlanta spa shootings suspect, despite campaigning against it. She said, and I'm quoting here, "Unfortunately, a case has arisen in the first few months of my term that I believe warrants the ultimate penalty." Is there a kind of a crime that you would ask for the death penalty for?
You know, our process is informed by a couple things. One is my deep experience with the death penalty, which includes my having served on a death penalty jury when I was 23 years old before I went to law school, and also my entire, you know, 30-year career as a lawyer, my studies in the field. But our process is that we have a committee in the office. The committee consists of senior people with vast experience around homicide, criminal justice, and the death penalty. Some of those people are in favor of the death penalty. Some of those people are not. And we consider cases on an individual basis. To date, we have not found a case where we believe that was appropriate to pursue the death penalty, but this is a decision that we make on an individual basis.
Let me get, looks like Anais to join our conversation. Anais, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there. Go ahead.
Hi, Marty. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
Mr. Krosner, I voted for you and I support your platform, but I'm just wondering, after an incident I had in February of 2020 where I was violently assaulted at random inside of a restaurant in Philadelphia, what are you doing to support victims and sort of accountability with the police force for crimes that are violent but might not include gun violence? I've had, you know, problems getting through to officers after this assault happened to me, just trying to get some closure on the case. There seemed to be no sort of like organization or support there. So I'm just wondering, outside of gun violence, how you're hoping to support victims and resolution on these crimes.
Anais, are you okay physically?
Yes. I'm okay. I still actually am experiencing jaw pain from time to time. I was knocked out. And like I said, it was completely random. It was 12 o'clock on a Sunday.
I hear you. Larry Krasner, what do you say?
Well, first of all, it's a terrible story. I'm really sorry to hear that. You know, being knocked out, having jaw problems so much later makes this a very serious aggravated assault. It's something we should all be concerned about. The fact that a stranger is involved puts up all kinds of flags in addition, that you're dealing with someone who will do this to anyone and apparently without any motivation. So that's, any motivation or provocation from someone familiar. So that is additionally very, very concerning. The date of your incident came right before the courts essentially closed. And I do not run the police department. I do not control them. I cannot speak specifically to what investigators may or may not have done, whether they did it right or not. But I certainly have a lot of sympathy and compassion for what it must be like to have that happen just on the edge of a pandemic when, it was no longer possible for them to do policing as usual. And, you know, the courts were closing and we had probation and parole shutting down in many different ways. I think that must be very, very difficult. What my office can do for you is, first of all, I'd love to put you in contact with our head of victim witness services, and that's Keziah Cameron, which is basically her name with a couple dots in it. It's Keziah dot Cameron, Cameron, at phila.gov. Please feel free to reach out to her, and anything we can do to support you, we will. We do more for victims and for witnesses than has been done in the past. We try to do it as well as we can. And our victim witness services have been working diligently throughout the pandemic. It's just that a lot of their work is remote now as opposed to in person. We prosecute violent cases vigorously. A big part of our essential promise here was that reform and lightening up on turnstile jumpers allows us to focus more intensively on serious crime. That is almost by definition violent crime. So we take that very seriously, and that's the kind of case that we will want to prosecute vigorously.
Anais, thank you for calling in, and good luck to you as well. Here's a tweet from Sheena. Krasner is letting people out of prison too fast. You can't just let people out of prison. There needs to be, and she has in here, CAPS programs to help them. Krasner seems to be doing a dangerous social experiment.
Well, again, I appreciate input. I can see that the FOP has done its job.
There's no evidence to say that Sheena's in league with the FOP.
No, I'm not saying that she's in league, but there is this word cloud that has been put out there that if people get out of jail, then Krasner has the keys to the door. That's not how our system works. We bring charges. We make recommendations. We make recommendations about bail all the time. And sometimes those recommendations are for very high bail, especially in violent cases. When judges do not do what we ask them to do, we need to be honest about this and say the DA's office sought high bail and a judge did not give it. When we have a judge who provides a sentence in a particular case, we need to be honest about the role that everyone is playing here. You know, the question I understand is coming from an honest place. I'm not saying it's fed by the FOP, but it is fed by massive misinformation that somehow suggests there's only one player in the criminal justice system. Probation and parole has no role. The courts have no role. The police department with 6,500 active officers has no role. If something's going wrong, then it must be the DA's office. And that's just not accurate.
You campaigned 4 years ago on eliminating cash bail. What kind of progress have you made on that?
I campaigned very specifically on pushing against cash bail, which is exactly what we have done. It has been one of the bigger frustrations of this term, to be clear. We've had great success in the following. We've had great success in being able to go into court and make recommendations to bail commissioners and judges for no money to be required on low-level non-serious offenses. And therefore, we've been able to get out of jail a lot of broke people on nonviolent and non-serious offenses who in prior administrations would have sat in jail at great expense to taxpayers for a long time on non-serious cases. That's worked out really well. The part that has not worked as well is that we have been very diligent about seeking very high bail for people we believe should remain in custody. These are on shooting cases. These are on, first-degree felony rape cases, aggravated assault cases, robbery with a gun cases, cases that I think we would all agree tear apart the fabric of society. And we have gotten much lower bails than we have requested. It is the judges who set the bails. And during a pandemic, in my opinion, there have been times when judges were too willing to give bails that were too low for really serious offenders. What we really need, though, is real simple. We need to eliminate cash bail entirely, and that requires a law passed by the legislature, which says, judges, you cannot use money as an aspect of bail. You either hold them or you release them. This is exactly the system that they have in D.C., where after 30 years of never allowing money to be involved, they have about 12% of people who sit in custody before their trials and about 88% who get out, but money is never involved. That's really what we need. And to the extent we're going to fix that, it's going to be by massive numbers of people turning out to vote in this election, in future elections, so we can get to the point where we have a Democratic legislature in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania that's willing to do things like end cash bail and is willing to do things like have reasonable gun regulation. That is much of where we need to go.
And that is Larry Krasner. He's the incumbent district attorney here in Philadelphia. He is running for re-election. The primary is next Tuesday on May 19th. And again, his Democratic challenger, Carlos Vega, will be our guest tomorrow on Radio Times. In the meantime, you can join us. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can pick up the phone and give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. What do you think of the call to, quote, defund the police? Do you like that?
You know, I think it is unfortunate terminology because it's confusing. You know, some people think that means let's eliminate all funding for police, eliminate the police. Some people think that means let us reduce the funding for police and put that funding into other things that they're not ideal to address. For example, you know, during the period of our mass incarceration, during our 500% increase in the number of people who were in custody, the period of time, the last 30, 40 years, when traditional prosecutors were just, you know, stacking jails full and then building more jails as they built more courthouses and prosecuted more cases. During that entire period of time, what we have seen is that we eliminated 85% of our mental health system. We eliminated it. And we turned our jails into residential facilities for people with mental illness. And we turned our police officers into first responders for mental illness. That is not fair to them. That is not appropriate for them. They're not trained for that. So in my mind, what defunding the police means at best is that we take chunks of our policing budget and we put it into things and agencies that will work better. Civilians dealing with mental illness is better than people who are carrying multiple weapons and are wearing body armor and are not trained to deal with mental illness dealing with mental illness. We need to take some of the funding out of policing and put it into things that are much more effective and keep us safer.
Let me read a couple of more comments because we only have a couple of more minutes before we have to say goodbye to you. This is from Andrew. Krasner's reforms are long overdue and making the criminal justice system a little more just. Comment from David. Krasner avoided answering why he is giving violent gun perpetrators plea deals. He also says he's cut the time down on gun cases, but is not commenting on the rate of conviction for them. It's easy to cut down on the time if you're letting people off instead of taking the time to convict. Convictions have decreased since he took office. Just taking that last sentence, is that true?
Convictions have decreased. I mean, I don't actually understand the question. You know, the notion that somehow there is a big difference in pleas, I don't understand where that comes from. All criminal justice systems function primarily on pleas. They are incapable of handling a trial in every single case, nor is a trial in the interest of victims and witnesses or defendants in every single case. So there's nothing inappropriate about having pleas of various different types. The plea results that we are seeing in the most serious cases, homicide cases, shooting cases, are actually quite similar to prior administrations because we do focus on them and we consider them to be very serious. There being no more specifics provided in that question, it's kind of hard for me to answer it beyond that.
I was reading about a number of diversion programs that your office is not using, including the Project Dawn Court, the small amounts of marijuana program, the accelerated misdemeanor program. Why not? These are diversion programs.
You know, the truth is that's largely inaccurate information. We've actually doubled the number of diversionary programs that are available. Let's talk about small amount of marijuana. We don't prosecute possession of marijuana anymore. We prosecute dealing. But the small amount of marijuana program existed when we when the DA's office prosecuted small amounts of marijuana. So there's no use for that. We eliminated it. I'm not sure how that looks like. We don't believe in diversion. If we talk about the Dawn Court program, unfortunately, discriminated based on sex. It was only for women. It was not for men. It was not for transgender people. And it was a program in which there were almost no new participants because the public defender's office repeatedly advised people who were arrested for sex work that what they should do is not accept Dawn Court, because when people went through a whole lot of hoops in Dawn Court and violated, sometimes they were getting long sentences and being sent upstate. So it was in a very bad state before we came in. We made a decision not to prosecute sex workers because we believe they are victims. And because we believe they are victims, we believe there should be a public health response to it. So, you know, the notion that we've gotten rid of AMP is just completely untrue. What we've done is lowered barriers so far more people can be in an AMP-like program. AMP used to require a lot of fines and costs from poor people. And so they get into it, but they could never get out of it because they could never pay up. And so we found a way that we could include people in an AMP-like program that would allow them to get in and out of it without paying fines and costs. We have made every effort to expand diversion. We've done a very, very good job at it. And frankly, my opponent simply wants to mislead. And that's why he comes up with that kind of information.
Well, we have to leave it there. Larry Krasner, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
All right. Thank you so much, Maury. Great to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you as well. And again, he is the incumbent district attorney here in Philadelphia running for re-election. The primary is next week. That's May 19th. It's a Tuesday. And his Democratic challenger, Carlos Vega, will be our guest tomorrow on Radio Times. In the meantime, we've got Jonathan Lai waiting in the wings. We'll be talking about some proposals out in Harrisburg that could affect the election code. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We just said goodbye to Philadelphia District Attorney Larry Krasner running for re-election on May 19th. That's next Tuesday. Just to reiterate, his Democratic challenger, Carlos Vega, is our guest tomorrow. Elections, as we know, have become highly partisan affairs, especially after the 2020 presidential race. Pennsylvania, you may recall, played a critical role giving Joe Biden the win over Donald Trump and was the subject of a number of lawsuits which were rejected by the courts. Republican-controlled legislatures across the country have been making their election laws more restrictive. Republicans in Harrisburg released a report on Monday that seeks to alter how Pennsylvanians vote in upcoming elections. Joining us is Jonathan Lai. He's the Philadelphia Inquirer's data and democracy reporter covering elections and voting. And Jonathan Lai, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good to be back.
Nice to have you back. And to our listeners, again, lines always open at 1-888-477-9499 to join our conversation. You can always send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. Jonathan, we wanted to talk to you because, frankly, you wrote about this 99-page report that was released on Monday. It was a report from Representative Seth Grove. He's a Republican from York County, also chair of the House State Government Committee. What was the genesis of this report? What was it responding to, or what is it responding to?
You know, it really comes back to the fall 2020 election. As you said, there was just so much controversy. And, you know, a lot of it fueled by misinformation, a lot of conspiracy theories, but there really was a lot of confusion. And, you know, there are people who don't trust the election system or just who have a lot of concerns. Now, you know, I always have to say we did have a free and fair election, both in Pennsylvania and across the entire country. But that doesn't mean that there aren't vulnerabilities, things that were exposed, things that we've known for a long time. You know, Pennsylvania has a very old election code going back to 1937. And so a lot of lawmakers, for various reasons, wanted to take a look at what we can do to change it.
And there were, 10 hearings that were held. Who was speaking? Who was talking to the legislature?
That's right. Now, the Senate, the state Senate, actually has been holding its own hearings. So there's just a lot of hours of testimony going on in Harrisburg. But the House, the State Government Committee, held 10 hearings. And, you know, it was a mix of people. For the most part, we were hearing from nonpartisan elections administrators, right? These are the people at the county level who are actually running elections. There were experts. There were elections officials from other states. You know, but then there were also some advocates from one side or the other who were a little more inflammatory.
And were Democrats involved? Was this a partisan or a bipartisan affair?
You know, in Harrisburg, everything is a partisan affair.
Fair enough.
But, you know, Democrats were involved. You know, Democrats are on the committee. Republicans control the state legislature, so they have a majority on the House State Government Committee. But there were Democrats involved. That said, it's very much a Republican-led effort.
And who is this Representative Seth Grove, Republican from York County? Tell us a bit about him.
Yeah, you know, Seth Grove has been in Harrisburg since, I want to say, 2008 was when he was elected. And, you know, he's not an ideological bomb thrower the way some of his colleagues are on either side of the aisle. He's really a little wonkier. We'll have to see what he actually proposes, but he's definitely not a bomb thrower. That said, I don't know that he's necessarily, you know, a moderate bipartisan actor either. Like, we have to see a little bit more. This is a relatively high profile position for him to be in, leading the House State Government Committee and the election efforts.
I thought it was interesting. He's quoted as telling you, and I am quoting here, we have a god-awful election law. We need to make voting easier and harder to cheat. I think people are still sort of recovering from the election of 2020. Does that seem like a fair representation about the election code in Pennsylvania?
You know, like I said, that election code, 1937, there are a lot of things in there that are old and outdated and, you know, weren't necessarily meant to be restrictive at the time, but just have become more and more restrictive as the world changes. That said, you know, there's always going to be this partisan divide where Republicans are more interested in election security, election integrity, right? And Democrats are more interested in expanding access. And those two things aren't always in conflict, but they can be.
And that is Jonathan Lai, again, Philadelphia Inquirer's data and democracy reporter covering elections and voting. I do need to correct myself. Yes, the primary is next Tuesday. That is correct. But the date is May 18th, not 19th. My apologies to our listeners. But in the meantime, we want to hear from you. We are talking about voting in Pennsylvania, interested in your experience. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can pick up the phone and give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Jonathan, we're talking about a report that was released. It's 99 pages. First of all, have you read all those pages?
I have, although I'll admit that some of them I skimmed a little bit.
Does that mean it's full of detail and nuance? What's in this report?
You know, the report is largely summarizing the hours of testimony that came from these 10 hearings. But what we do get are these, I don't even know whether to call them recommendations, right? They're not explicit, detailed recommendations, but they sort of outline what Grove is interested in. Mm-hmm. And in this case, what Representative Grove is interested in represents what party leadership is interested in. They've backed his process, they've backed his ideas. And so the kinds of ideas that are sort of outlined in this report are the ones that we can expect House Republicans to bring to the negotiating table.
I realize they're not fully fleshed out, but let me just go through a couple of things that frankly, you wrote about. One is looking for more uniformity. We have, you know, multiple, you know, small districts, frankly, in Pennsylvania where people get to vote. Looking for uniformity across the Commonwealth. Can you help us understand what this report is going for here?
Sure, that's a bit of a talking point and a point of tension depending on where you stand. You know, elections are administered at the county level, which means that Pennsylvania, with 67 counties, is actually running 67 elections on election day. The state doesn't administer them. So that means that 67 counties take slightly different policies, they have slightly different procedures. This is why the voting machines in Philadelphia are different from the voting machines in Montgomery County. And there is the idea that last fall, the guidance or the rules or the procedures weren't uniform enough. Republicans in particular have criticized this, you know, saying the state needs to have one set of rules, one set of policies all across the state. Now, some degree of variation is normal. It's natural. In fact, it's what you want. You don't want the same rules and procedures in every single county. I mean, consider the diversity of counties Sure. and regions we have in Pennsylvania.
I mean, comparing Philadelphia to some of the more sparsely populated counties, for instance.
That's right. You know, I don't know that a Franklin County set of rules works for Philadelphia and vice versa.
Many people had a chance to use mail-in ballots. Obviously, this was a result of a decision by the legislature to allow mail-in ballots. Are they sort of back on the table again?
You know, this is a little bit hard to tell. Pennsylvania had a really restrictive absentee voting system until last year. Last year was the first time any voter who wanted to could vote by mail without having to provide a reason for doing so. But that's also created a lot of controversy. As you recall, former President Donald Trump had a lot of misinformation and disinformation around, you know, the security of mail voting. And look, it for the first year you roll out mail voting in Pennsylvania to be a major presidential election, there are growing pains.
Well, and you're in the middle of a pandemic on top of it, correct?
Doesn't make things any easier.
Right, right. So that's at least something that they are looking at. It, I mean, doesn't sound like there's a decision yet about the future of mail-in ballots. I don't want to, you know, get ahead of the legislature on this. What about things like signature verification?
Yeah, this is another one of those subjects that really got touchy. You know, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, in a series of rulings last year, made a bunch of decisions that Republicans really disagreed with. And, you know, they believe that the Pennsylvania Supreme Court oversteps anyway. And in this particular case, the state Supreme Court said the law and the Constitution do not require signature verification. That means that whatever, you know, I use to sign my mail ballot doesn't get compared with what's on my voter registration form or something else. And there are a lot of Republicans who say that's a vulnerability. For security's sake, we need stronger signature verification, or like any signature verification at all. But, you know, that also gets very tough. People's signatures change as they get older or for various other reasons. When was the last time? Like, I don't know what my voter registration signature looks like.
And I'm also curious. I mean, we've got a primary in a couple of days on May 18th. That's Tuesday. So whatever's being discussed and whatever's in this report would not apply to the primary, correct?
That's right. I mean, this is going to be a process that takes place over weeks and months as you negotiate. You know, again, this is just a report. This is just an outline. We don't even have actual legislation proposed yet. You know, the plan right now is to introduce something as early as the end of this month, more likely sometime in June. And then it might take effect for this November's election, but certainly the Republicans in Harrisburg want it to take effect for next year's 2022 elections, which will be very high profile because of an open Senate seat in an open gubernatorial seat.
Well, and so thinking that possibly this year there could be some kind of new election code, but we don't know yet.
That's right. And, you know, one of the big concerns here is just going to be the whiplash that voters get.
Right.
You know, we've changed each of the last several elections. Things have looked different for voters. We've had new machines, then we've had new procedures, then we've had even more new procedures change. And so voter confusion is something we really have to watch for. So something I'm going to be watching for is how do we communicate these changes to voters? Because otherwise, it's just going to be really confusing.
And that comes from what, the Department of State?
I mean, that comes from everybody, right?
Right.
The legislature has to be involved here. The Pennsylvania Department of State, which oversees elections, has to be involved here. counties have to be involved here. And that's not just the county elections officials, but that's things like in Philadelphia that'll have to be like city council and the mayor's office, in other counties that'll have to be the commissioners. You know, these things will take resources, it will take time and energy. But the last thing you want to do is leave voters confused about what the elections look like.
Absolutely. Voter ID has been a contentious issue in Pennsylvania. It was fought and rejected by the courts. It's happening in other states as well. Looking at this 99-page report, is there anything about what might happen with voter ID?
You know, there is. And this is going to be one of the hot areas, I think, that is going to be very contentious. You know, as you said, Pennsylvania actually passed a very restrictive, very strict voter ID law in the early 2010s, and it was rejected by the courts, and it never took effect. But other states have continued to increase their voter ID laws. They've become stricter. Pennsylvania right now has a pretty weak voter ID law. You only have to show your voter ID if it's your first time voting in person at a precinct. You know, so if you're a first-time voter or if you've moved. But otherwise, you don't have to show a photo ID or anything like that. Republicans really want it. You know, again, this is another area where Republicans say we need stricter security, we need voter ID laws. And Democrats say no, because there's a lot of research showing, you know, there are some marginalized groups, including older people, people with disabilities, poor and low-income voters, people of color, who have less access to state-issued IDs. And so they're worried about access there.
Interestingly, back in 2020, which seems, you know, ages ago, drop boxes became very controversial. I mean, these are places where people can literally just drop their ballot. Again, looking at this report and realizing we're at the very beginning stages, what does this say, if anything, about drop boxes?
You know, this is really interesting. The report accepts drop boxes as a given. And I talked to Representative Grove about that. And you know, there have been these ideas that we need to just ban drop boxes altogether. And his response to me was, he accepts them. Drop boxes are here, people are using them. But what he's interested in is saying, how do we standardize them? Because the law really doesn't say anything about drop boxes or what they have to look like.
Oh, really?
And in some states, you know, like if you go to Philadelphia, like they're a secure drop box, but it's basically like one of those post office boxes, right? You just put your thing in. There are states where it's so secure they have like keypads that you have to put in like your personal information in order to drop a ballot in. And you know, there are all these different rules and regulations. And so that needs to be figured out. If, you know, that's what Representative Grove has told me, is if we're going to move forward with drop boxes, which he's not opposed to, there just needs to be more tightening of the security there.
Wow.
Now, of course, what that looks like, you know, I can see a lot of Democrats and advocates being really against it, depending on what kind of measures they put in place.
About a minute before we have to say goodbye here. Now, of course, I guess Governor Wolf gets to either, whatever they come up with, gets to either sign on the dotted line or veto. Any sense about where the governor stands on all of this?
That's right. He gets the veto power. You know, his office told us that they didn't want to comment and they just pointed us to their previous statements. It's hard to tell what's going on with regard to negotiations. There was a brief flare-up between the governor's office and Seth Grove, actually, a few days ago or early last week. Well, it remains to be seen. You know, in the past, they have worked together. Republican leadership in Harrisburg and Governor Wolf, who's a Democrat, worked together in 2019 to create some major election changes, which gave us these mail ballots in the first place. You know, but then last summer and last fall, they were not working together at all, and they were taking shots at each other in public. So it remains to be seen.
Well, Jonathan Lai, we're going to leave it there. Thank you, as always, for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Absolutely. He is a Philadelphia Inquirer's data and democracy reporter covering elections and voting. And again, the May primary is next Tuesday, or this coming up Tuesday. That is May 18th. May 18th is Tuesday coming up. Make sure you get to the polls and vote, or mail that ballot in. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.